Now, what about anything else that happened while you were at the Orkneys?
The naval base in Orkney was at Lyness, which was on the island of Hoy. I suppose it's characteristic that you find that the army headquarters and the naval headquarters are on different islands, so they didn't communicate too well. But I can remember that when Christmas was approaching, 1944, I got 45. An urgent... 45, will it? Yes. I got an urgent call from one of the staff officers in Line S, the Admiral, who had an estate in the borders. His factor had failed to send the birds that were required for Christmas in time on the railway, and I was asked to stop one of the trains at the station in the borders so as to ensure that the birds were put aboard. I remember talking to an NCO of the Royal Engineers in London and arranging for the train to be stopped, and I in due course got the word of thanks from the Admiral for so doing.
Okay, anything else before you would...
No, I think I'm talking about silly things, I suppose, that happened. When the B release came through...
It was in January 1946.
January 1946. I went through the stage known as D-Mob Happy, where nothing seemed to be of any relevance now that I knew that in a few days' time I was going to leave the army and going to find other things to do. I was in a state of euphoria, perhaps, as I made my way south to receive my civilian kit from the NEMOB establishment in Edinburgh and caught the train home to Yorkshire, where my parents lived.
What was the DMOB suit like, as far as you were concerned?
It was a chalk white on a black background. There were many such. It lasted a year or two.
You actually wore it then?
Oh, indeed, yes. Of course, I was as an undergraduate. It was my smart gear, I suppose, because I went back to Oxford and.
Now, you'd finish one year, would that be right?
I went back to Oxford to complete my degree. I should have done 3 years or 9 terms. In fact, I did 2 and a bit years and 8 terms. So I took my finals and got a first-class honours degree in philosophy, politics and economics. I had considered what I was to do in civilian life, and decided that since in my service days I got more satisfaction out of being a regimental officer than being a staff officer, and I really preferred to deal with other ranks than a lot of clever staff officers, and so I went into the manufacturing side. I told the appointments people at Oxford that I wanted to go into a manufacturing unit, the head of the appointments side in Oxford had recently being the personnel manager of Tootle Broadhurst Lee in Manchester, and he recommended I went to his old firm, and I did.
Which type of manufacturing were you involved to be involved in?
Well, I ran factories, and I came to Manchester to run a factory that made handkerchiefs, ties, and other things. My first task was to increase the output of the factory from 12,000 dozen ties a week to 24,000 dozen ties a week. Having made a success of that, I moved my way through the various manufacturing sides and eventually became responsible for all the factory side that was involved in garment making, and so I made clothing of all kinds. Perhaps I should mention there was an alternative career that I could have had. When I completed, towards the end of my time in Oxford, the final interview to decide whether or not I would receive a first-class honours degree, there were half a dozen dons, 2 for politics, 2 from economics, and 2 from philosophy, and they questioned me, and in the event they decided I should have the first-class honours degree, and the senior economics man was Harrod, later Lord Harrod, and he urged me to consider joining a merchant bank in London. And I did go to look at the Merchant Bank in London, and I was greeted by a flunky in a powdered wig and tights, and shown the way to the lift, which took me up one floor, where I was met by another flunky, who put me into a waiting room before I saw the senior man that I was to interview with. And being a North Country grammar school type, I suppose, I found this flummery of the city was not... remember, I had decided that I wanted the factory situation and not the office situation, so I decided that I did not wish to go join this firm, particularly perhaps when I realised that the first 2 years would be spent working in Paris. I felt I had been in France long enough. And anyway, at that stage in my life, I had more ambitions of setting down and establishing myself as a civilian with a home and family, perhaps. But
Did you have any difficulties sort of rehabilitating yourself or getting yourself back into civilian life? Mental or physical, or, you know, I mean...
Well, yes, I remember going back to Oxford that I could read the same textbook without knowing how I'd seen it before. I could read my pre-war essays with interest and not knowing what was coming next. Yes, I suppose one had to adjust and acclimatise.
I
think we were probably very serious and academic, determinedly getting ourselves back into a civilian mode. And so there was not... after the First War, there was a lot of stories of a lot of light-hearted larking around Oxford by returned. There was nothing of that in my experience.
So not, you had not too serious problems, it was just you overcame whatever?
Indeed, yes. I remember that one of the people who was in one of the digs, who had been in one of the Guards regiments, I remember he was having difficulty coming to terms with life, but I did not have that experience.
Now, the last thing really we want to do is your career as a territorial, because you had some rather interesting staff postings, which we'd like to... look at if we can. Well, when did you join the territorials? Or could you give us a sketch in the background of what happened?
When I started to work in Manchester in Tudor Orders Lee, I was in reading the newspaper and saw that a new territorial light anti-aircraft regiment was being formed in Cheshire, and the man who was forming it, the name of Lieutenant Colonel W.J.C. Todd, was, of course, the man I had found myself subordinate to when I returned from Dunkirk. And so I wrote to him, and I was rapidly found myself the battery commander of the battery that was to be formed in Hale in Cheshire.
Now, so what was the number of the light anti-aircraft?
349.
That was the regiment?
That 349.
And what was the battery? Not quite sure.
I think it must have been a numbered battery. I don't remember the number.
That's all right. But it was the Hale battery.
Yes, it was.
Now, what could you describe your role as a territorial? What exactly did being commander of the Hale battery entail?
Well, at that time, it was in formation, and so it did not exist. What I had was a permanent staff instructor, a regular sergeant in the Royal Artillery. He was a Gibraltarian, we were using a territorial army drill hall in Hale that belonged to an infantry company, and we had a room in that. It was now necessary to build up a unit. I had to find officers. And indeed I had to find premises, because we clearly would not wish to stay in the sharing a drill hall with an infantry company. So I had to find premises. I remember talking to Gidlow Jackson, who was the Member of Parliament for Altrincham and Sale, where it would be a good place, and after a good deal of hesitation, since he did not wish to be quoted as preferring one part of his constituency to another, he advised me that he thought Sale would be a better place to raise soldiers than Altrincham. And so it was to Sale that I looked, and I found a site near the town hall in Sale, in Britannia Road, and a local architect was found who put up temporary accommodation which formed the regiment, which formed the battery headquarters, so that we moved there from Hale. I had established a number of officers who worked in the neighbourhood. One of the men worked for the Walls Company on the butchery side, on the meat side, the sausage side. Another of them was in the local electrical accessory equipment in Withenshaw. And we had the nucleus of the Hale, or now called the Sale Battery. The appointment that I had to the new 349 regiment was dated the 7th of October 48, which was when the thing started, and I was promoted to be the second in command of it in 1st of November 52. The regiment headquarters were in Chester, and so I found that that was where I increasingly went. And the regiment comprised a battery in Crewe, a battery in Hoylake with a subsidiary in Haswell, and the one that I've spoken of in Hale and then Sale. I was appointed to the DA QMG appointment at 2 Agra, brackets anti-aircraft. That is a regular formation.
Is that as well? Or
no, that's after.
So when did this finish, your time at 349?
Well, that's when in May 55, the anti-aircraft territorials were being reduced, and the regiment in Chester was now being merged with one further south, I think in Newcastle under Lyme. And the headquarters were being moved from Chester. At that time, my job with Tootle Broadhurst Lee meant that I was no longer living in Altrincham, and I was going to live in Ormskirk. And so I was transferred into a formation in Warrington. The Warrington formation was a regular unit.
This was as Deputy Adjutant Quartermaster General, would that be right?
Deputy Assistant. DAAQMD, Deputy Assistant Adjutant and Quartermaster General. It's a Major's appointment. 2 Agra was a regular headquarters, but in peacetime, the A and Q staff work was handled from Western Command, and so there was no requirement for A and Q staff officers until mobilisation. And so on that headquarters, there was a deputy commander who was a territorial, and there was myself and another who were the two A and Q staff officers. Under command of that headquarters, there were a number of regular regiments as far away as Pembroke Dock, but there were also territorial units too.
This was 2 Agra.
2 Agra. The headquarters was in Peninsula Barracks, Warrington. There was, I suppose, the usual complement of the brigadier, the brigade major, the various other staff officers, but there would be no A and Q staff because that was me. Well, I was one of I was A and Q. It was there was an officer's mess. I can remember an episode when we were saying goodbye to one of the regulars. I left the party. I was working civilian, remember. I left the party, I suppose, 10:30. By 2 o'clock in the morning, it had got more lively. And the bowls from the officers' mess bowls were fired from the cannon stood outside the doors of the officers' mess, going through the windows of some council houses nearby, which got a lot of reference in the local press. It was then taken by the army as an object lesson in how to deal with the press. I remember Colonel Pring being adept at mollifying the press over this light-hearted exercise. But yes, there was a headquarters, and they got up to the mischief from time to time. We exercised the the unit in various places.
So what exactly were your duties?
My duties were... there was no day-to-day duties because that was handled by the Western Command people. And so it was an ad hoc exercise. My fortnight's camp might well be conducted by doing some training course somewhere, but there were also occasions upon which the whole of the Agra would be engaged in some activity. I can remember conducting a court of inquiry in the regular unit that was based at Hailee, which is not far from where we are now. There had been an unfortunate episode in which some explosion had taken place in a fireplace in an officer's mess, and a lot of the furniture had been damaged, and a court of inquiry had to be established to decide who should pay for this. And I was encouraged to report that perhaps the thing had been due to some explosive that unfortunately the coal board had left inside the coal that had been put in the fireplace. But it
didn't sound very likely.
It didn't sound too likely, but I had to air the possibility so that through A and Q staffs they could consider where the responsibility lay. I can also remember being involved in the Plymouth... the Pembroke dock battery. But there was no day-to-day routine to follow.
They'd started there on when about?
I was appointed DAQMD on the 10th of May 55 for 3 years, and it was extended for a further 2 years. When Duagra went into suspended animation.
So basically, it was what was the level of your contribution? I mean, how often would you have to go to
Warrington? I did not have to go. It was a matter of keeping contact and knowing the people and being there if required. I knew, of course, well the brigade major and some of the senior staff officers. I remember particularly a Major Spann, S-P-A-N-N, who had amusing stories about people who confused his name. I knew it was my job to know the brigadier and the staff and the regimental people, so that if mobilization were to happen, I would be able to fit in and take a role in it, but there was no day-to-day responsibility, and so I was 5 years there when the Agra was disbanded or put into suspended animation.
And now, why was that?
Well, again, remember, over this period, Territorial Army was being reduced and the anti-aircraft component was further being reduced, and also the regular army was being reduced, so the two Agra, which had a long history, went into suspended animation in April 59, I see, and I was posted to another Agra, a 40 Agra, also anti-aircraft, but I was not there for very long before I was transferred.
Now, what were you sent there as?
I was there. I don't remember what my appointment was there. I was certainly posted to the headquarters. I can remember the brigade major, but I'm very vague.
Where was the headquarters? I don't remember.
I don't really remember. It was Hailee or somewhere of that ilk. It was not far away. Knutsford was where the brigade major lived. And
that was in 59?
That was 59, by the autumn of that year, I was posted to the Manchester garrison, to 127 brackets East Lancs, close brackets Infantry Brigade TA, which was stationed at Bellevue. That comprised a regular brigadier and a regular brigade major and the territorial staff that was responsible for the infantry regiments in the brigade, and I was posted there as a G2 civil defence, which now reminds me what the role was that I had in 40 Agra. The role I had in 40 Agra was civil defence. I was and I was trained at the civil defence in civil defence by the army, so I came with the experience of that course.
So you went to Bellevue in 1959. Bellevue Barracks, is it?
It was a gunner unit at that time, but also it had the headquarters of 127 Infantry Brigade.
Now, what exactly was the civil defence course you'd done, and what were your what were your civil defence responsibilities?
Well, the civil defence course that I had done was to understand how civil defence worked in organisation terms, and technically, of course, we were taught about the effects of the various chemical and biological threats that one might receive. This was done not at Porton, but near Porton. There is a military training establishment that concentrated on ABC war, atomic, bacterial and chemical warfare. Lost its name, I'm afraid, somewhere in the Salisbury Plain area. And I had done that course, and I had also done another course, forgotten where now, again dealing with the question of civil defence and chemical warfare. The role I had in Manchester Garrison was both to know about the units under command, but also to know how to communicate and who to communicate with in the civil emergency services, the police, the ambulance and the fire people. And my post on mobilisation would have been in the concrete bunker that exists still today, I think, next to the Alexandra Hospital. There is an underground bunker where the representatives of the various civil, military and other organisations would have been in the case of atomic war. This related to the possibility of atomic war. As soon as the hydrogen bomb was developed, the defence systems had to change to accommodate the much greater threat. But at the time of atomic war, that was where the area of defence for this part of the world. And I was familiar, of course, with the mobilisation arrangements. The intention was that territorial units would be mobilised and would be moved to positions outside the main conurbation area, so that were they required for any post atomic bomb strike, they could come in and do whatever they could. And so we were rehearsed on the various possibilities of atomic warfare. I can remember being deterred when we were living in Ormskirk to see that on one of the exercises they assumed a bomb had been dropped, and the fallout of radiation was plotted now using the actual climate of the day. And I can remember that the highest density of radiation would have affected my home in Ormskirk at the time, which was
How realistic were the arrangements, as far as actually carrying them out in the event of a real atomic strike? I mean, would it have worked, do you think?
I expect so. I was there simply doing my role in the system. I couldn't really appraise the effectiveness, and I'm sure one couldn't without actually carrying through an atomic bomb explosion to prove it. What one was hoping that one would achieve was by being ready that one would not occur, perhaps rather like the territorial, but rather like the coast artillery role. It was deterrence, and the fact that you had... I used to deal with the retired Major General who was responsible for civil defence in the northwest. The emergency arrangements in case of war, you had various commanders. What's the word? I've forgotten what they call them now. But there was there were 10 areas in Britain, and the northwest was one, therefore I was familiar in dealing with him. His offices were in about a mile or two from here, in what had been an emergency hospital arrangement in the event of atomic war, and I can remember being with him on events in places like the Liverpool Town Hall, where we were dealing with the people in that part of Lancashire.
Did liaison with the civilian services go well, the police, the...
Yes, there's no... there was no difficulty about the matter. At a later stage, after I had left the army and had become a councillor in the city of Manchester, there was a strong belief on the part of the Labour Party, its left wing, that they should have nothing whatever to do with anything involving atomic warfare. And I remember the deputy town clerk was forbidden to go on one of the training courses that were held to teach the civil defence rules to local authorities and the like. But that was later. So there must, I suppose, have been in my time, but not known to me, people who were opposed to the whole idea of civil defence.
Anything else about your time with as G2 Civil Defence Manchester?
Coming by now, I had come to live in Manchester, and the civil defence role at Manchester Garrison was... I enjoyed the connection, but I was now running out of time, and I also developed gallstones in my gallbladder, which from time to time produced acute pain. The first time this happened was when I was with the brigade major of the infantry brigade. He realised that something had happened, and I remember he brought my car back to my house, and one of the soldiers brought my car back. The doctors were adamant that there was nothing whatever wrong with me. The mnemonic the doctors have for gallstones is that you should be fat, furty, forty, and fertile. In those days, I was very thin, and they could not reconcile themselves to the fact that my trouble was anything other than in the mind. And it was for some considerable period of time, as the doctor, his partner, consultant at the Withington Hospital all went through, but because I had bupa cover, they sent me to have x-rays taken, and by chance, the x-rays were wide enough to cover the gallbladder, and they saw to their amazement that there was a physical reason for my complaint. But by then I had left the Territorial Army because I was told that I should take life more quietly, and so I was winding down all my activities. And I, but anyway, I had to, because I'd reached the age limit. I went on to the... my appointment as G2 Civil Defence, it was originally for 3 years. It was extended for a further 2.5 until August 66. But I went on to the Taro, having exceeded the age limit for Territorial Army officers.
So that was the end of your connections with the Army?
Yes, that is so. There is the amusing episode I had a year or two ago, where I received a letter from a lady addressed to William Aikman, Major Royal Artillery, NATO Headquarters, Mons, Belgium, in which she thanked me for looking after her, and I was made inquiries and wrote back to her saying I couldn't trace the Aikman and it certainly wasn't me, and I got a letter back from her saying, oh silly me, he was a major of the Royal Canadian Artillery, and I heard him from time to time on the radio as our NATO spokesman in the activities in Kosovo, but I never met him.
That wasn't you. Thank you very much.